Welcome to the Paleo View. I'm bestselling author and co-creator of realeverything.com, Stacy Toth. I focus on being healthy inside and out through real life, food, and talk.
I'm Dr. Sarah Ballantyne, New York Times bestselling author and creator of thepaleomom.com. I'm passionate about improving scientific literacy around public health topics.
I like hashtags and bone broth.
And I'm just a super nerd.
Welcome back, listeners. You are on episode 328 of the Paleo View. Whoop, whoop. Sarah, we survived. Welcome back.
We survived, but we have to apologize to our listeners.
Because we didn't deliver.
We did not. Last week in our little check-in show, we're like, we're going to be together, and clearly we're going to do an Instagram Live or a Facebook Live or we're going to do something for, you know, like, and we did nothing.
You know what we did? We hung out and enjoyed each other's company in person, and it was great.
We ate a lot of good food. We played some board games. We all sat around a table glued to our own screens doing Black Friday shopping together, which was one of my favorite moments.
We snuggled the puppy.
We did, and a few toddlers as well. And there was the joyous sounds of kids mostly playing in the background. Few occasional moments of disagreement. But survival of the fittest, they figured it out.
And now we're back, as promised. But we did share on social media, both of us. So hopefully our listeners were able to follow along if they're into that sort of thing. And I think it's a good life lesson of living in the moment. There wasn't very much time either. Like, even though it was 4 days for you, you arrived late your first day here because you spent it all in the car. And then the fourth day you spent it all in the car because you left early in the morning. So it was really only 2 days. And one of those we just spent it cooking the entire time for Thanksgiving. And then the next day we spent the majority of the day cooking for Friendsgiving, although we did go downtown a little bit. And while you apologize to our listeners, I will out myself and apologize to you, Sarah, because we totally dairied your daughter.
Oh, yeah.
So it happened because I had to take a work call. I was supervising muffins we were specifically making to be dairy-free because the one that I'd gotten from the gluten-free bakery had dairy in them. And so we had this gluten-free muffin mix that I knew was okay because we'd used it before and specifically purchased ghee that I knew would be okay for you guys and set it out on the counter. And then I said, okay, I have to go take a work call. And then I took a shower. And when I came back down, the ghee was still unopened on the counter and Mira had eaten a muffin. And I was like, oh God, what happened?
Made with butter. But this is one of the things though, that was really like, so when I'm teaching the Autoimmune Protocol Lecture Series, we have a whole lecture on reintroductions, and people get really scared to do reintroductions because they're like, what if it goes wrong? And I really like to emphasize that there is a tremendous amount of knowledge and really important knowledge in that experience of things going wrong. It's a really, really important and really, in the end, empowering experience to go through, because not only do you find out, yes, that food like unequivocally doesn't work for me, but then you have this whole, like, I view the Autoimmune Protocol as like a toolkit for healing. So then you like, you just reach back into your AIP toolkit and you go sleep, hydration, broth, right? Gut health foods, nutrient density, like all of these things that you use to heal. And it's so much faster when you're just, you know, a failed reintroduction is not the same typically for most people as like how sick they were before they ever, you know, started the Autoimmune Protocol. And for her, we hadn't tried any kind of dairy whatsoever in 2 years. And I was starting to wonder if it was time to try and see how it went. And that was a very, very small amount. It was butter in a muffin mix and she had one muffin. And the other thing that was really fortuitous was because she was sharing a room with her sister, her sister was able to report to me, yeah, she had this really strange, like, breathing at night, like it was really weird. And she described it. And I was like, aha, well, that was the breathing that she had when she had obstructive sleep apnea. That was one of the, like, it was a huge thing. It took us like 2 years to really thoroughly diagnose it and link it to gluten and dairy. It started when she was 9 months old, and we figured it out when she was about 2.5. And so I was like, you know, that's, I wouldn't have gotten that if I had done a reintroduction in my house. I wouldn't have been able to hear that breathing pattern, you know, through the wall of her bedroom. Like, I wouldn't have had that piece of information. So it ended up being this, like, really amazing confluence of events where I'm like, aha, like, I now have all of the information that I need that, like, yes, even a very small amount of dairy does cause the same reaction that she had as a 9-month-old. And I couldn't have designed an experiment in my house that would have given me that information. Like, that was really fantastic. And it sucked for her because she slept terribly because she had sleep apnea all night. And she was basically an emotional wreck for three days afterwards. But, you know, she's bounced back. She's resilient. And, you know, now we have this great piece of information. Now we know that the effort we go through on a daily basis to not cross-contaminate dairy for her is still really important. And that's really good information. Like, I'm really thankful to have that information.
Well, I appreciate you being so positive about it because it was very stressful for me. And I think a good way to have our listeners see that, you know, sometimes mistakes happen, mm-hmm. and being stressed out about them and being super negative about them doesn't help it go any better either. Right. Yeah. So it's like, okay, well, it's happened now. What can we do and move forward? So, full admission, my child poisoned your child.
But just a little Moving bit on. Of poison. She even had a really great attitude because I was saying the other day, I was like, I was going to make something with cultured ghee, which is normally fine. But I was like, maybe we should just avoid like even ghee for a little while and really let your system like completely recover. Because now, you know, we know that you had that reaction to dairy. And she goes, but I didn't throw up. Like, she was like super, like she was like high-fiving, like, woohoo. So for her, there was victory in that as well, because the last time we did try dairy, that's what happened. So, you know, she also doesn't have like any hard feelings about the experience. So I hope the son who shall not be named who made the muffins doesn't feel bad.
The irony is it's the son who is also sensitive to dairy. So it's just, and I think that's the thing is for him, he's okay with butter.
Yeah.
And so it hadn't occurred to him that that would be a problem. But,
right.
You know, we each have our own individual bio N=1 kind of things. And our family's just fallen into, oh, well, these are the things that we know are okay for certain people. And, it was a good reminder for us of, you know, needing to be a little more thoughtful about other people's needs. So we were obviously very glad that she did not have any worse of a reaction as well. But
yeah, we all are. That would have put a damper on Thanksgiving, yes, that's for sure.
Yes. Well, I'm just sitting here sipping my tea, wondering what we're going to talk about today.
That... It's an excellent segue.
Ba-dum-bum.
So we did a podcast a couple weeks ago where I started to get to share some of this like really exciting information that I am like learning as I'm writing the new gut health book, which I am really, really trying to finish up so that it can like be officially announced early in the new year. So light is getting pretty bright in the tunnel. But it's such a busy time of year and I'm trying to get it finished with less time than normal. But, I asked if we could like maybe start taking some more of those topics that are like really fascinating to me, like things that just really, I wasn't expecting as I was researching for this book. And what's been fascinating about researching for this book is the amount of information that to me is so informative. It's so groundbreaking. And it really tells us this is a good food. This is a bad food, right? It really distills some the benefits of certain foods beyond just their nutritional value, because they're foods that support a healthy and diverse gut microbiome, and being able to take that information and put into a book. No, but like, it's just, it's stuff that nobody has talked about. And I think it's just these studies that they're in obscure enough journals. It's separate enough from what we typically read in sort of the alternative health sphere. It's not nutritional sciences really. So we don't really think of it in terms of, crafting an optimal human diet. We're not really looking at that research yet, but it's got so much information that informs an optimal human diet, because we can't be healthy without a healthy and diverse gut microbiome. Like, I put together a list of all of the axes. So all of the, like, you know, this, you know, the gut-brain axis is the best known example. So there's a direct connection and communication and influence between our brain and our gut bacteria. So I was going through the research, oh, this was a few weeks ago now, and I was like, okay, so I know there's a gut-brain axis, and I know there's a gut-skin axis, and I've heard of this gut-hormone axis. Let's continue down this line. And so there's a gut-brain axis, a gut-skin axis, a gut-bone axis, a gut-liver axis, a gut-lung axis, a gut-thyroid axis, a gut-heart axis, a gut-muscle axis, a gut-kidney axis, a gut-endocrine axis, a gut-adipose tissue axis, a gut-eye axis, a gut-pancreas axis, a gut-joint axis, and get this one, there is a gut-gut axis. And it just, it really crystallizes, I've been sort of putting this information together, that our gut bacteria are literally controlling every system in our body. They're literally controlling how leaky the blood-brain barrier is. Like, it's crazy. And they're controlling the gut barrier. Like, it's they influence every single system. By the time you influence neurotransmitters, the immune system, and hormones, well, that's it. You're touching every single cell in the human body. And so I'm starting to view health and things that are good for our health and things that are bad for our health entirely as being mediated through the gut microbiome. So as I hit on this, like, oh my gosh, here's this food that is super beneficial for the gut microbiome. And we don't talk about this enough in the paleo movement. That has really, to me, been like the most exciting thing. So we're going to have another podcast where we talk about a fun new food that is.
I was wondering if you were going to reveal that, because we talked about it here at the house with Russ, who we failed to mention was also here from The Domestic Man, our favorite home cook and big proponent of the perfect health diet, which includes this magical food that's good for your gut.
It is. It happens to be the food that you are sipping right now. I guess it's not really food. It's a beverage. It's a magic gut microbiome improving beverage called tea.
And I happen to sip it quite often, with collagen included, which I'm sure is another added benefit of gut health. But I am looking forward to hearing about the scientific mechanisms of tea. I know that it's an antioxidant, but there's so much more to it based on the pages and pages of notes that you've prepared. But before we jump into all of those, I do want to thank our sponsor for this week's show, Peak Tea. And that's spelled Q-U-E. So P-I-Q-U-E-T-E-A. And if you go to peaktea.life/thepaleoview, you can get 28% off plus free shipping on Peak Tea. What's interesting about this tea, like, different than others, is that it comes in crystals versus a bag, which for most store-bought teas, those bags are cheap and often contain BPA, and you're literally soaking it in hot water, which is not great. So what I love about Peak Tea, as someone who has spent a lot of time researching the negative effects of things like that on our bodies, is that it doesn't have any packets or anything like that. It just melts into your hot water, dissolves, so to speak. Supposedly, you can also dissolve it in cold water, but I've actually never tried that myself. Have you, Sarah?
I have. So they have, I don't know, like 15 different flavors between different black teas and green teas and herbal teas. And they'll say, like, right on the box, whether or not that particular one dissolves in both hot and cold or just hot. So the ones that dissolve in cold, like, they've got an entire iced tea line, which is really delicious. And those ones, like, I've mixed it with, like, water kefir, homemade water kefir. It's just really plain. So that's my favorite thing to add flavoring to, homemade water kefir. But you can just mix it with plain water and then it's like an iced tea right away. One of the things that I love the tea crystals because I am a very huge tea snob. I was raised as a tea snob because my family is descendant from, like, British aristocracy. So we used to, like, when I was a kid.
Sorry, I just want to highlight that for a minute.
Right. I used to be told, so my grandparents actually had lunch with the Queen. And so I was brought up with, like, you have to know how to set a table properly and know where all, like, the forks and knives and spoon, like, all of the different things go. And you have to know how to, like, eat your soup by spooning away from you instead of towards you. Like, you have to have all these manners because you never know when you're going to have lunch with the Queen.
is a threat we tell the kids all the time, and they've got no chance.
My grandparents actually did it. And so it was like, oh, okay. But my family, because we were such, like, we really leaned into our British heritage. We used to, like, get together for tea. Like, that was, we didn't have afternoon snack. We had tea time. Like, it was, and it was a low tea. It wasn't usually a high tea. If we got together with, like, elderly relatives, then we'd have a high tea. They're just basically fancy tea versus not fancy tea. But I was so raised to, like, don't you ever make tea with, like, hot water in the microwave or hot water out of the tap. Like, it was like, preheat the teapot and then the water has to be the perfect temperature. And it's a different temperature for black tea versus green tea versus white tea. And then it has to steep for the right number of minutes. And it's a different number of minutes for black tea versus green tea versus white tea. And I like, that was just part of my upbringing. And so the thing that I love the most, because that was such a part of my upbringing, I also have a very snobby tea palate. Like, my taste buds for tea are very, very picky. Like, they really only want tea made in that perfect way. And Peak Tea, like, makes their tea. It's super high quality tea. And they make it in the perfect way for whatever the tea is. And then they basically dehydrate it to crystals so that you can dissolve those crystals into, it doesn't have to be boiling water anymore. It can just be water that's the perfect temperature to drink. And it can be that hot water out of the tap or heated in the microwave. And then it's like a perfect cup of tea. So, like, the tea snob in me is super, super, super in love with Peak Tea. Plus, it's, like, crazy convenient too. That's also super bonus.
And they're also, like, triple checked for toxins and different kinds of things on the tea leaves. It's a very high quality, safe, healthy tea before it's turned into the crystals, which is fantastic. And one of the things I know you're going to talk about is the polyphenols in the tea leaves and all of that kind of antioxidants in it. So obviously, the higher the quality of the tea leaf that you're starting with, the higher the result and the better it is on the back end. You don't want to be concentrating something that has pesticides on it because then you are intensifying right. your toxic load. So just as a reminder, that's peaktea.life/thepaleoview for 28% off and free shipping. And we'll include a link in the show notes if you're not sure how to spell that and all that kind of stuff. So thank you again to our sponsor, Peak Tea, for not just sponsoring the show, but also offering you listeners a discount. That's my favorite kind of show sponsors because I want to hook you guys up, and 28% off is pretty fantastic. So, all right, Sarah, explain to us why it's good to drink tea.
So you hit the nail on the head. It really is the polyphenols. I mean, tea has something like 2,000 different compounds in them, hundreds of which are different polyphenols, but that is the main compound that is mediating the majority of the health benefits. So I think it would be good to sort of like back up a second and like when I'm talking about tea and when I'm looking at the research on tea in the microbiome, I really mean tea that is from the Camellia sinensis plant, which is black tea, green tea, and white tea. So herbal teas also have lots of benefit. There are types of herbal teas that are also really high in polyphenols, but not all of them. But some of them have like other phytochemicals. So herbal teas are also really beneficial, but they're kind of a different beast. So when you're looking at tea research, it's generally black tea and green tea. Like that's where most of the research lies. And it's because green tea and black tea are very unique in terms of their polyphenols and their polyphenol content. So they come from the same plant. And what is different between a white and a green and a black tea is how the leaves are treated. So they're picked, they're typically fermented and then dried. And it's basically how long they're fermented that's the difference. So a white tea is either not fermented or it's fermented for a very short period of time and then it's heat treated to stop the fermentation and then dried. Green teas fall in the what's called like semi-fermented spectrum. So they can be anywhere between like 10%, 80% fermented. So something like a jasmine tea would sort of typically fall on the lightly fermented side. And then something like an oolong would be on the heavily fermented side. And then if it's fully fermented, like the tea leaves are 100% fermented, then that's black teas. And then where you get different, right, the difference between a Darjeeling and an Assam tea, for example, is where the leaves are grown, because that where the plants are grown is typically changes a little bit of nuance, right? Just like slightly different grapes will give you a very different wine. The same thing is true from tea plants grown in different regions. And then sometimes you add flavoring, right? So like a Earl Grey tea would have something like bergamot added to it. That's the stereotypical flavor that we associate with Earl Grey, actually comes from the bergamot, not from the tea. So then you might add, or like jasmine tea has jasmine leaves added to it. It's a green tea with jasmine leaves. So that then we can sometimes get into the added flavorings, either from flowers is very typical, but also right, citrus rind or spices will get added to a tea, right? Like a chai tea is a black tea with right cloves and cinnamon and allspice added. So that's where we
start. Bonus sort of antioxidants is what right. I heard there.
Yeah, and that's actually what's really exciting is that teas in general, but like herbs in general, herbs and spices in general are some of the most antioxidant dense, right? Like the phytochemicals are what give those plants their really pungent flavors. They're herbs and spices because it needs only a very small amount to flavor a whole dish. Like you can imagine that if you could get the flavor of broccoli in a pinch of dried broccoli, like broccoli would be a spice, but it's not because you have to like it's not concentrated in its flavor the way something like cinnamon is or ginger or, I don't know, pepper. Like those things have really, really intense flavor in a very small package. And what gives them the flavor is this incredibly high concentration of different phytochemicals, some of which are polyphenols, like the phytochemicals in tea, but polyphenols are just one out of many, many classes of phytochemicals. So there's many others to choose from that, you know, like will give these plants their very stereotypical flavors. So when you add these additional flavoring agents to a tea, typically you're adding even more beneficial antioxidant, anti-inflammatory, anti-cancer, right? That often these compounds are antimicrobial. You're adding even more of these compounds to your tea. But black tea and green tea are very special because they of course, they can't contain caffeine, and there's not very many herbal teas that contain caffeine. I can only think of one other, but I might be missing some. And then they're actually incredibly rich in phytochemicals. So, for example, if you compared to like a rooibos tea, which is also a very health promoting herbal tea, has, you know, benefits digestion. It has, it's calming. It's caffeine free. It's, got a lot of sort of very, very well established, scientifically studied health benefits. Green and black tea still has double to triple the amount of polyphenols compared to a rooibos. If you were to compare it to a chamomile, it has like 20 times more polyphenols than a chamomile tea. So not, I mean, chamomile does have some other benefits, right? It has the highly relaxing benefit. But this is what sets black tea and green tea apart, is this very, very high concentration of polyphenols. And what's really interesting is the detailed composition, which I won't get into because it's just basically me going to be spouting chemical names for 5 minutes. But the detailed composition difference between green tea and black tea comes from the fermentation. So a lot of the compounds that are in green tea that are like, especially green tea has a lot of compounds associated with reducing diabetes risk and weight loss. That's why there's all these green tea supplements for weight loss. Although let's just say right now, there's actually lots of problems with those supplements. It's, you don't seem to get the health benefit by concentrating one particular polyphenol out of tea into a supplement. You get the benefit when you just drink green tea, or you have like a whole green tea powder that's got the entire, everything that's in green tea in the powder. But those chemicals are fermented. So this even actually happens in our gut. So our gut bacteria actually process phytochemicals, especially polyphenols. And polyphenols have a huge impact on the health of our gut bacteria and the composition of our gut bacteria, which we'll get to more in a bit. But they actually, they chemically process those polyphenols, making different variations that we then absorb. And then when you ferment something, you're basically concentrating that process outside of the body so that you get even more of those chemicals. So when you ferment black tea, you're, for example, converting a lot of the catechins that are in green tea into different phytochemicals that also are, you know, linked to health benefits, but they're called theophlavins. They're derived from it, and it's the bacteria in the fermentation that actually create them. So this is one of the things that's really interesting, is a lot of research, there's some research that separates green tea and black tea, or that just looks at one or the other, and some research that pulls them together. So it's a little bit challenging at this point to take a step back and say, white tea is better than green tea is better than black tea, because white tea has the most sort of unmodified polyphenols and black tea has the most modified polyphenols, but you can't actually say that. The research right now, it's kind of like how eating broccoli and kale and carrots is better than just eating one or the other. The same sort of goes with tea, that you get different polyphenols from different teas, that even within those semi-fermented green teas, it's really good to sometimes have a jasmine tea and sometimes have an oolong and sometimes have, you know, something else completely different. So tea is really, really fascinating and really, really complex, because it has so many different compounds in it. And it has been linked, you know, drinking tea on a regular basis has been linked to really outstanding health benefits. And there's even been, in certain fields, there's been prospective studies that have been done. It's not just like, let me look at the observational ones. We're like, let me look at these people and see if they're healthy or not, and then find out how much tea they drink and then make an inference from that. So some, I mean, certainly that's where you start with a lot of this type of research. But prospective studies is, let me take these people, find out how much tea they drink, and then follow them and see what happens, which when you find out how much tea they drink, that's sort of like, for a diet study, that's as close as you can get to randomization. And it's basically considered self-randomization. And then you follow them and you say, well, like these people who drank a lot of tea, they had lower risk of developing type 2 diabetes, for example. So the strongest research is probably in type 2 diabetes and cardiovascular disease risk. What's been really cool with cardiovascular disease risk, there's actually been intervention studies where you're saying, these people have cardiovascular disease risk factors. I'm going to give them more. I'm going to make them drink tea and see what happens, compared to the people who drink, I'm going to make those people drink water or whatever, you know, whatever the control is. And these studies have actually proven that tea lowers LDL, bad cholesterol, that it's quite potently anti-inflammatory and antioxidant. It lowers blood pressure, and all of those things are cardiovascular disease risk factors. So it's probably that combination that is why, when you look at, you know, the prospective and observational studies, that you see a reduced risk in cardiovascular disease. But you can actually intervene with tea and see a reduction in risk factors, which is really cool. There's also studies linking, as I sort of already mentioned, with green tea, linking tea consumption. It's really green and black, but it seems to be stronger with green tea, to improved weight loss and obesity. There's some evidence that tea consumption can lower risk of at least some kinds of cancers. I think liver cancer is probably the one that has the strongest evidence behind it. There's some evidence, although again, this is like, it's an emerging field. So there's still more research that needs to be needed before you can sort of reach a consensus and say conclusively. But tea consumption actually appears to increase bone mineral density, so reducing osteoporosis and osteoporosis-related fractures, which is very, very cool. It also related.
So can I ask? Do you think that's about nutrient sufficiency? Because when I was doing a lot of research about bone health during my lifting days, that was like one of the key indicators to like cravings and what to eat after you lift was actually to kind of like make sure you're focusing on nutrient sufficiency for helping that bone density. Was there a triggering mechanism there?
Not likely, because tea is not actually high in any of the nutrients that are classic bone health nutrients. Mm-hmm. So classic bone health nutrients would be like vitamin A, vitamin D, vitamin C, a lot of the minerals. So not just calcium, but magnesium, phosphorus, potassium, right? Glycine, a really important amino acid for bone health. So it probably has more to do with signaling to bone-forming cells. So we know that there's this very tight link between bone-forming cells and their activity and insulin signaling. So insulin, when you're sensitive to insulin, insulin stimulates osteoblast activity, which form bone, because our bones are sort of constantly being broken down and reformed. So they stimulate osteoblast activity, which is the cells that form bone, and insulin suppresses osteoclast activity, which are the cells that they kind of undo bone, right? They dissolve bone. And so that's one of the reasons why you have increased fracture risk with type 2 diabetes, is because when insulin can't do that signaling, you end up sort of interfering with that equilibrium in bone demineralization and bone remineralization. And then once you restore insulin sensitivity, you can restore that balance and reverse things like osteoporosis. So because there seems to be a link between polyphenols and inflammation, and there's a link between inflammation and insulin sensitivity, that's probably the most direct line to bone formation. It probably has a lot more to do with signaling than it does with actual raw nutrition. And that's probably also true of the link with tooth decay. So drinking more tea seems to reduce risk of cavities as well as dental plaque and gingivitis. And that's probably through insulin sensitivity and sort of anti-inflammatory mechanisms, because all of those things are linked with inflammation.
Makes sense.
So in the continued list of like cool things that drinking tea does, it also lowers risk of kidney stones. And this one is really cool because tea actually contains some oxalates. So this is like a whole separate tangent, but I've been really interested in the oxalate kidney stone link, because vegetables that contain oxalates like radishes and turnips, right? That's what gives them that super kind of like peppery. That's what's in radishes that makes them taste radishy. That actually increasing intake of oxalate containing vegetables lowers risk of kidney stones, despite the fact that the most common form of kidney stone is made out of calcium oxalate crystals. And it's probably mediated through the gut microbiome because there's a type of bacteria that degrades oxalates. I think it's called something like oxalicobacter. It's been a while since I've looked at that literature, so I might have that name. I might have an extra syllable, or I might be missing three syllables.
What? It's not in these 17 pages of notes you've got here?
No, because this is a tangent. See, it's a
tangent. It's a side tangent, not included in the notes.
But to me, this is really interesting because we see sort of over and over again that natural food sources of oxalates actually reduce kidney stones, and it's likely through these anti-inflammatory mechanisms, but also through the gut microbiome. It's a section that I haven't finished writing for the book, so I don't have all of the answers yet. But that's just like a cool tangent on the drink tea and reduce kidney stone intake. And there's also some new evidence that's I think really exciting, showing that tea consumption can prevent age-associated cognitive decline, like dementia. There's actually probably the strongest link is actually probably with Parkinson's disease, which because I just had a birthday. So anything that reduces age-associated cognitive decline sounds great to me.
It's interesting to me as well because it has run in my mother's adopted's family. So mm-hmm. It won't actually trickle down to us because it's not in our genetics, but it's been something that I've done a lot of research on because my grandfather died of Parkinson's. So that's really fascinating information that I had not come across yet.
Yeah. I love when science confirms that's something that I love is good for me. So I guess we all kind of do.
Not that we're biased in looking for that information.
No,
or anything.
I mean, I'm a person, you know, so this is something that's a little bit different about me versus other science writers is that I have a PhD in medical biophysics, and my training was very centered around being able to read the full body of scientific literature and really honor the nuance, honor the contradictions, while also accepting consensus, right? So it's a very different way of reading the scientific literature. So when I read the literature, I go, hey, there's the situation where something, you know, doesn't work the way we think it does. So this isn't quite clear cut. But the vast body of scientific literature shows this thing. And that's why, you know, the articles on my website are so long, is because I really think that it's important to admit the limits of human knowledge and talk about the majority opinion in the science while not dismissing contradictory information. And so what you'll find often in especially sort of like pseudoscience, and again, we're going off on a tangent, but you'll often find that I think this is kind of it's part of this is also just the internet culture right now, is that people aren't looking for an answer to a question. They're looking for the information that confirms that their suspicions were correct, right? So we're looking for affirmation, not information. And that is not the way that I approach researching a topic. I really try to wrap my head around the entire question and all of the bits of the answer and try to put them together in a cohesive picture without dismissing something. So what's cool with the tea literature is that that's like 99.9% is actually – the polyphenols in tea have been very, very well studied in a variety of different situations. And so what's really affirming for me is that the information actually is that overwhelmingly positive. So in this particular case, there's other, foods that I'm researching for the book that are much more nuanced. And it is a lot more of a, this is a really good food for the gut microbiome for these people and not for these people. So there is nuance in some of these other foods. Tea just seems to be really beneficial. The science is pretty cut and dried.
Well, I'm glad because it is something I consume every single day. But I do want to reiterate that the kind of tea that you get when you go to the grocery store and it's like a main brand tea and the price is very low, unless it's on sale and you know the quality of the tea, be mindful because it really is the kind of thing that you get what you pay for. And as we said earlier, these things are concentrated and you're soaking them in hot water. And so the kind of benefits that we're talking about, I'm sure the science does not exist that they're negated when they're lower quality, but you're introducing different kinds of toxins to your system that aren't going to be as beneficial if you just splurge a little bit more for the higher quality tea, which is why I'm excited that we have a sponsor for the show that is a quality tea that you and I both use, that we can stand behind, offering a discount for you to try something. There are a variety of options, but just don't jump into, oh, well, now I need to drink more tea, and so I'm gonna buy this one brand on the shelf and this is the cheapest one, because based on some of the research I've found, you can actually introduce a lot of issues from doing that. So just be mindful of the type of tea that you're purchasing.
Let me add some data to back up what you just said, because I think that's really, really important. So one thing to keep in mind is that conventional tea is some of the most highly sprayed with pesticides crops out there. So getting a cheap tea has the potential to have a lot of different pesticide residues on it, which interferes with immune function and endocrine function. Like, it's the evidence we have about pesticide consumption from conventional foods for most people is very weak. Most of the evidence we have on the damage that pesticides can do is more from like gardeners using it in their garden, like that sort of level of exposure. But when you can sort of tease out those effects, they're pretty concerning. And given the probably large percentage of our listeners who have come to this podcast because of chronic disease, like autoimmune disease, that's a really worthwhile concern. So limiting pesticide exposure where possible, and tea is an important place to do that. There's also been studies that have actually looked at the polyphenol content of different teas. So there's one study that I read a while back, so I don't remember like exactly which brands they had, but they basically went and bought like 10 different brands in the grocery store and measured the polyphenol content of all of these different brands of tea, and showed that from the basically the cheapest tea to the highest quality tea, there was about a five-fold difference. So the best tea that they tested had five times more polyphenols than the worst tea. And it was basically, you know, the entire point of that article was like quality matters here when it comes to tea. And when it comes to Peak Tea, the reason why they're such a synergistic sponsor for this episode is that they test the antioxidant capacity of their teas, and their teas are so high quality that they're about 12 times better than sort of like the average grocery store tea that you would get. So given that the health benefits of teas are mediated through the polyphenols, it makes a lot of sense to be looking for that high antioxidant polyphenol content.
I love it when I say something and you say, yes, you're right. And you said it twice on this show. I'm like living for this moment.
It's, you know, it's that spending 2 days together and just getting our brainwaves like aligned. That must be it.
Must be it. So one of the questions that I hear all the time about tea is caffeine. Mm-hmm. And tea has more caffeine than coffee, or,
no,
you know, blah, blah, blah. Can we bust some of those myths?
We sure can, because I put that in my notes under the extra info just in case section. So actually, some of the benefits of tea are mediated through caffeine. And this is why there's some health benefits to coffee as well. Coffee has not as high polyphenol content as tea does, something like half of the polyphenol content. So coffee would be sort of similar to a rooibos tea, for example. But caffeine itself actually has some health benefits. So most importantly, caffeine is anti-inflammatory. To an extent. So this is why we see a lot of benefits with the like tea. It's like the 3 to 6 cup range. And then beyond that, you're not really helping yourself out anymore. With coffee, it's typically the 3 cup range, because coffee does have a lot more caffeine than tea. And it depends on the type of tea. So I think the first thing is like caffeine by itself is not bad. Caffeine, when consumed later in the day, can disrupt sleep quality. Caffeine, when taken to excess, can disrupt sleep quality. Caffeine, when you're psychologically stressed, can magnify your stress response. So there are some caveats with caffeine, but caffeine isn't sort of like inherently bad. It's actually anti-inflammatory. And also the neuroprotective effects of tea are probably mediated through caffeine, not the polyphenols. So the part where tea consumption reduces cognitive decline associated with age, that is attributable to the caffeine content, not to the polyphenol content. So there's, provided you're consuming caffeinated teas in the earlier half of the day, you're not going crazy, your sleep quality is good, this might be a good case for knowing if you're a fast caffeine metabolizer or a slow caffeine metabolizer, which you can find out with any of the sort of general genetic tests that are out there will tell you that. And I have an article on my website that will tell you exactly what genes to look for and what they mean. So we can put a link to that article in the show notes. But caffeine itself is not necessarily bad when consumed appropriately. Coffee has 95 milligrams per cup, 95 milligrams of caffeine per cup of coffee on average. Black tea has a little bit less than half of that at about 40 milligrams per cup on average. Green tea is less than that. So like you can see it's the caffeine is actually produced as part of the fermentation. So black tea has the most of all the teas. Green tea has less. So oolong tea, which is the sort of longer semi-fermented, has like 30 to 35 milligrams per cup. A green tea that is fermented less, like jasmine, would have something like 20 milligrams per cup. So that's about a fifth the amount of coffee. And white tea can be almost caffeine-free, depending on the white tea. So between 1 and, say, 15 milligrams per cup of white tea. So tea is definitely lower caffeine.
Do you know, and I'm putting you on the spot here because I'm looking at the notes and I know that it's not there, how much is in decaf coffee? Because there's a little bit in...
Decaf coffee is about a quarter the amount of regular coffee. So that puts it at about 20-ish milligrams per cup, which is about the same as a cup of green tea.
I would have guessed that because I get the exact same kind of response to green tea as I do decaf coffee, because I am not a good metabolizer of caffeine. Mm-hmm. I'm the kind of person that if I drink a regular cup of coffee, I get the shakes. So I prefer Americanos or decaf or a really dark espresso roast where a lot of the caffeine's been roasted out. But that's really super helpful information, because I know people hear all the time, well, because it's, for example, matcha concentrated, it's got all this extra caffeine. It's 4 times as much as coffee. And I'm like, I don't think that's true, because my body doesn't feel like it's buzzing the way that it does when I drink coffee. So good information.
Yeah. And actually, I think it's also like tangentially related. So caffeine is really produced in the fermentation process of taking tea leaves and making green or black tea. And the compounds that are degraded, the catechins that are degraded from green tea to black tea, they're also stimulants, but they're not as potent as caffeine. And they last like 4 times longer on average for most people. So it gives you this like little boost of energy that lasts a really long time. So it can actually boost your metabolism. Again, this is probably why green tea is linked to you know, weight reduction in obesity studies. It's likely has something to do with this metabolism boosting effect, but there is some other compounds in green tea that have a stimulant effect similar to caffeine, not as strong as caffeine, but then lasting longer than caffeine. So I think that that's kind of an interesting thing to bring into it, because some people do find that like green tea makes them really buzzed. And that's because those are people who are more sensitive to the catechins than they are to the caffeine.
Fascinating. That could be something I'm not sensitive to versus caffeine. So awesome. What have we missed?
We have missed the details of what tea polyphenols do to the gut microbiome. That is super exciting.
Give me the science. I know you're waiting for it.
So this is, to me, what is really, really interesting is that tea polyphenols appear to support the growth of the most important probiotic bacteria, the Bifidobacterium genus and the Lactobacillus genus, which between the two of them represents, you know, something like 180 different, roughly 180 different bacteria that can live in our guts. And Bifidobacterium and Lactobacillus are the workhorses of the gut microbiome. They're the guys that make all of those most important short chain fatty acids and lactic acid that are so important for the health of our gut lining, of our gut barriers. They're our dominant vitamin producers. They make, upwards of like 80% of the vitamin B6 in our bodies was actually made by our gut bacteria. We didn't actually get it from our food. Like, they're super, super cool. And as you go through all the literature, the two types of bacteria that come up again and again and again as being the most important and the ones that are always depleted in disease are Bifidobacterium and Lactobacillus. And tea feeds them. So they love the polyphenols in tea. They really thrive in that. It's basically food for them. But then the other side of it is tea polyphenols have some antiviral and antimicrobial properties, and it seems to be preferentially inhibiting the growth of some pathogenic strains like Clostridium difficile, which is what causes that antibiotic-induced chronic bacteria that's so horrible. C. difficile has actually been in the news a little bit more lately because fecal microbiota transplants are catching the public's imagination. Those are only USDA approved for treating C. difficile infections. And what's interesting about C. difficile is it used to be a purely hospital acquired infection. And now it's an infection that we're seeing outside of hospital environments. And one of the things that can help make C. difficile not grow and support these probiotics is tea. So there have been a variety of studies where they have basically fed tea to either like animal models of the human microbiome or to people and measured what that's done to their gut microbiota. And both green and black tea seem to have benefits. They not only increase microbial diversity, which is the most important, like fundamental aspect of a healthy gut microbiome, is a large amount of diversity. The increased growth of Bifidobacterium and Lactobacillus. They also shift the microbiome from an obesity-related microbiome to a lean-associated microbiome. So they really change that shift from – there's this very stereotypical sort of ratio of types of bacteria in the gut microbiome that's associated with obesity versus leanness. And even in studies where – like mice are fed high-fat diets that would cause this shift towards an obesity microbiome, giving them green tea powder and a Lactobacillus probiotic led to way more diversity in their gut microbiomes. And that Lactobacillus probiotic that they fed the mice didn't do that by itself. It needed the green tea powder to flourish. So that study even insinuates that you would get more basically bang for your buck out of taking a probiotic if you also consumed green tea. And because you're providing that substrate for the probiotic strains to thrive, which is super cool. Studies have shown that black tea polyphenols actually increase levels of a type of bacteria called Pseudobutyrovibrio, which is associated with higher energy metabolism. It's associated with higher production of short-chain fatty acids, which is also super, super beneficial. There have been studies that have actually looked at the microbiome that is associated with colon cancer and the microbiome that is associated with colitis, and found that green tea actually reverses the cancer-related changes in the gut microbiome. So this might be one of the ways in which green tea may reduce cancer risk, which is super cool. And so all of this is really exciting. And then also we see in humans the same, so we've got a tremendous body of scientific literature in rats and mice, which are these types of studies are very good reflections of what happens in humans. And then it's confirmed in humans. There was a study where what they did was they gave people green tea 3 cups a day for 10 days and looked at the difference in just 10 days on their microbiome and found that tea increased bifidobacterium, which is, again, like one of the most important classes. So it's a genus of bacteria in the gut and inhibits the growth of very sort of pathogenic strains like C. difficile. So that information is, I think, very, very exciting. It's very, very exciting to see. It really doesn't have to be, you know, 2 to 3 cups a day can mediate these effects. It doesn't have to be, you know, taking green tea powder and adding it to a smoothie because it's the only way we can consume enough. So that is the other thing that's really exciting about this research is it's levels of intake that mimic average human consumption. So the cool thing is the summary is like, not only is green tea full of these really important antioxidants, not only can it protect against potentially cancer and heart disease and diabetes and asthma and osteoporosis and neurodegenerative diseases and reduce inflammation and reduce oxidative stress and help the immune system, you know, to regulate itself and help nerve cells perform better and help the heart muscle cells perform better. Like, there's all of these amazing effects of tea polyphenols. And then there's this like, aha, it's just like seal the deal. And it's really, really good for the gut microbiome. So it really does, I think, make a very, very strong case for intentionally consuming tea, not just consuming tea because you're a person who happens like me and Stacey who happens to find it delicious, but because it's a food that is a functional food, right? It really is mediating diverse health benefits. And I'm just happy that my favorite beverage is so healthy for me.
Ditto. All right. Now that we're all drinking our high quality tea and feeding our friends, you didn't refer to your microbiome reference this episode, and I'm severely disappointed.
I didn't refer to them as my internal pets.
Yes, there you go.
Do you know? Here's the thing that is just so dorky about that. In order to say the words internal pets, I had to rub my belly in a really kind of creepy way. Like, it's like, oh, my pets. It happened, and I don't know how to make it not happen. But yes, I do refer to my microbiome as my pets, and I am cuddling with them right now.
I am also giving mine a lovely cuddle as I finish my cup of tea that I've been sipping on this episode. So thank you, listeners, for joining us, and want to remind you that if you're feeling like you want to partake in high quality tea, our sponsor this week, peaktea.life/thepaleoview, is offering 28% off plus free shipping for you. And if you enjoyed this podcast, as always, your review and your referrals and your comments and share on social media all help us reach a broader audience, and we cannot thank you enough for your support. You can find show notes on thepaleomom.com and realeverything.com. Thank you so much for tuning in.
And we'll be back next week.
As always.
Thank you for listening to The Paleo View. If you enjoyed the show, please take a moment to rate us on iTunes. You can also support us by shopping for our favorite paleo products on the sidebars of our individual websites or by donating through PayPal.